How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Monday, June 10th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the weekend's box office numbers. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer and box office analyst Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan. Last week, we hoped against hope that when we got around to today's show, you would have some good news to share with us about the box office. And I was actually fully offline this weekend, so I have not seen any conversations at all about how things went for movies like Bad Boys for Life. Is that the name of it? Bad Boys Ride or Die. Sorry, Ride or Die. So now that we're here, I'm very curious if you actually do have some good news for us or not.
Ben, I do have some good news for you. Although I will say this has been brought up a lot, but I think if they knew for sure they were going to make four Bad Boys movies, they probably would have named the fourth one Bad Boys for Life. But they didn't know for sure. But in any event, so Bad Boys Ride or Die, the sequel to 2020's Bad Boys for Life, entered theaters, and it did just a little bit better than tracking had suggested. So this is one of those like unsexy good results. So it made looks like the numbers has updated official numbers here. So yeah, so at $56.5 million domestically, which is great. It was tracking for around 50, give or take. Bad Boys for Life opened to 62 in January 2020. So you have almost identical audience retention here, save for a handful of million dollars, which I could chalk that up personally to the fact that Bad Boys for Life opened in January, whereas Bad Boys Ride or Die is opening in summer, where it's always there's always a little bit more competition in some ways, whereas January is like a complete wasteland. Mm-hmm. Plus there was that whole like, you know, Bad Boys for Life was the first time, you know, the franchise has been back in like 17 years and the beginning of 2020 was a more promising, you know, theatrical landscape than we exist in now. All of this to say that the $5 or $6 million that Bad Boys Ride or Die is missing compared to the previous entry is negligible. It's, you know, an almost identical opening, which is great. So the audience retention there is really good. It also took in $48.6 million internationally. So it essentially opened $105 million worldwide, which is great. It had a $100 million budget. So, you know, matching your budget on opening weekend is great. This could easily get to $300 million or more by the end of its run, which would pretty much put it in profits for Sony. And I mean, a cinema score, 97% audience rating on Rotten Tomatoes. The critics were a little bit more mixed, but I mean, the audience is what matters here. It's generally been positive. So, I mean, this to me is, it's great. It's like on an individual basis, this is great. That there's more to be said, certainly in the bigger picture, but you know, as an individual movie, fantastic.
Yeah. I've not seen Ride or Die. I did not see Bad Boys for Life either. So, I've only seen half of the Bad Boys franchise so far. But yeah, everything that I saw just anecdotally was people being like, hey, this is fun. This is like a good time at the movie. So, that's the kind of thing that we want to be seeing these days. But
right. And I think what it really was is someone who saw Bad Boys for Life was one of the last movies they saw in theaters before the pandemic. And also worth noting, Bad Boys for Life by default ended up being the biggest American movie of 2020 just because theater shut down, whatever else, but it was a really big hit. I think that audience retention was more like, hey, I want to see another one of these, you know, with an older Marcus and an older Mike and some of these new characters. And I think what Sony wisely did was marketed this one as not like some legacy sequel, not as some franchise expansion, not as some like some of the things we so often see. They were just like, it is another Bad Boys movie. Did you like that last Bad Boys movie? Because guess what? This is another Bad Boys movie. Mm-hmm. Like, they were really, really straightforward about it. And I think that actually helped a lot. It wasn't some part one or part two thing. It wasn't some big mystery that was going to be like left out of the marketing. It just was really selling exactly what it was. And I think that there's probably a lesson there, but that was one of my bigger takeaways.
Yeah, you mentioned there being a lot to say sort of in the grander picture of everything. And I guess living up to our promise that we established last week, why don't you run through the top 10 at the box office right up here, sort of close to the top of the show.
Indeed, I will. So let's go over it. Bad Boys, Ride or Die, as mentioned, took the number one spot with a $56.5 million domestic haul. The Garfield movie staying very strong at number two, dropping just 29% with $10 million. If John Krasinski's animated live-action hybrid held on to the number three spot with another $8 million, dropping just 24%. The Watchers, Warner Brothers' new horror movie, opened at number four with a $7 million haul. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes came in at number five with a $5.4 million haul, dropping just 40% in its fifth weekend. Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, plummeted another 61%. With $4.2 million and lost 880 screens in the process, it is heading into life support mode. The Fall Guy, still holding somewhat strong despite being on VOD, coming in at number seven with $2.7 million, dropping 36% in its sixth weekend. And in the eight and nine spots, respectively, we have the re-releases of The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship and the Ring, and The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, taking in $2.4 million and $1.9 million. That was through Fathom Events. And then rounding out the top 10, we have The Strangers Chapter 1 with $1.8 million, despite the fact that that just hit VOD as well. So that is your top 10, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, so what takeaways do you have from the performance of some of these movies, or maybe some of the placement of these movies on this list?
Well, let's go top down. So my biggest thing right now is the Garfield movie. You know, that seemed a little disappointing. Its domestic opening against Furiosa the Memorial Day weekend was really bad, so it sort of colored this movie a little incorrectly, even in, but this movie's holding like gangbusters. And look, right now it is at $192.7 million worldwide against a $60 million budget. It's going to easily, I mean, it's essentially already in profits, and it could get somewhere closer to $300 million than $200 million by the end of it. I'm not saying it will touch $300 million, but I'm saying the final number might be closer to. So Sony held the number two spots this weekend with reasonably budgeted audience-friendly films. And I think one of my biggest things is that there was a lot of discussion about, oh, is Will Smith still a movie star after? I don't want to even talk about the slap. I'm just, the court of public opinion has weighed in, and Will Smith is still very much a movie star. But another thing, for as much as people are a little in our circle seem to be tired of it, Chris Pratt is a huge movie star, and there's no denying that. The man is huge added value to anything he touches, as evidenced by how well this Garfield movie is holding. General public loves the guy. And I think that, you know, we've talked a little bit about certain movie stars that weirdly don't seem to justify their status based on the numbers. Chris Pratt is a guy who the numbers support he is a movie star. So, you know, that kind of fascinates me.
Yeah, it's interesting because we were talking about how that movie did not really come strong out of the gate. And I think a lot of folks were wondering if like his like iron grasp on that sort of stardom, and especially like the kid friendly stardom, was maybe starting to slip a little bit. But it seems like the way the movie is, I guess, holding over the course of these weeks now seems to indicate that maybe there were other factors at play rather than like his stardom that were maybe keeping people away opening weekend or whatever. And now it's like, you know, bearing out that the movie seems to be, I guess, a good investment if you want to look at it in those terms.
Yeah. And that's exactly what it is. It is a good investment. Like, it, you know, against a $60 million budget, you're going to have a movie that, say, let's say it gets to 250. What is that? That's more than four times your budget. I mean, that's all day long. Every studio is going to take that. You know, again, like there's bigger conversations to be made about, well, okay, how do you get a big animated movie made for $60 million? Well, you're probably cutting some corners somewhere. You know, there's a reason a Pixar movie cost $200 million, but you know, like that's the world we live in. And Sony is embracing that, like to make these movies, work and to continue to have a business that functions, you can't spend $200 million to make the movie. Mm-hmm. You know, you pay Chris Pratt because he gets people in the door, and that seems to be bearing out. So yeah, that's what I would say. And then the other thing I think we should probably talk about is The Watchers, because that opened this weekend. Did you get a chance to see this?
Yes, BJ and I talked about it on Friday's episode of the show. We had a couple interviews with the folks behind the movie. We were both, I think, mixed on it is probably the most fair way that we could say. Like, we both thought that Shana Night Shyamalan, the director, showed a lot of promise, but maybe like the script wasn't the strongest thing I've ever seen, to put it kindly.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, what we're seeing here is that I haven't got a chance to see it yet, but so $7 million opening is pretty weak for this. It's yet another example of like a big horror movie kind of not meeting expectations. But again, it's got like a C minus cinema score. It's like 20 something percent on Rotten Tomatoes. You know, it's not like an embraced movie. And I think what we see, you know, what we're seeing is just this year, just like the continued sort of like, I think the industry had sort of hoped like, okay, we'll get these breakout horror hits. And we just haven't come close to having one of those this year. But at the same time, if you look at all of the American horror movies that have come out, like, they're either mixed reviews, average reviews, like you don't have a Smile, a Megan, or a Black Phone, partially because you don't have a Smile, a Megan, or a Black Phone. Like, all of those like really were embraced both critically and by audiences, and just everything. It seems to me, I think the evidence is mounting that it's more of a slate issue this year than it is like horror is dying. You know, because I think that's sort of like the narrative I've seen a little bit, is that like, oh no, horror had its bubble and now that's starting to burst. And I don't think that's true. I just think it's more of a slate issue.
It's interesting to, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just like,
no, go ahead.
Because Furiosa I thought was great, and Fall Guy I thought was great. Like, I think across the board, both those movies have pretty high, you know, they're like well-respected, critically liked, whatever, like movies that that are not garbage, you know, cash in kind of things for whatever their franchise is, right? Sure. So I wonder though, like, if there is something that seems like a larger conversation for us to have maybe at some point about like the because the quality is there for those movies and people aren't showing up in the way that we would hope. So yes. Like maybe that same thing applies to, like, I understand what you're saying, that like these movies are not great, and like the horror movies are not great and don't have that same level of support, but I wonder if like there's just I don't know if there's something else contributing to why people aren't showing up, you know, like I'm not sure that the quality matters in the same way across the board that it might have used to, like word of mouth and stuff like that, because like I said, some of these other movies are pretty good and they're not performing financially.
Yeah, I think the slight difference there is that horror has always kind of been its own thing. In that, like, the rules that apply to other things don't necessarily apply to horror. Like, horror can be shockingly resilient in the face of terrible reviews. Like, you know, the only real outright flop, even taking into account that we haven't had a Smile or one of those big, big breakouts, like an Evil Dead Rise or whatever, like anything. Night Swim, very mixed reviews, still got to 54 million worldwide. Tarot, a movie with terrible reviews, crossed $45 million this weekend. Like, these movies are shockingly resilient. The Strangers Chapter 1, very, very, very terrible reviews, probably going to touch 40 million worldwide. Like, so it's a shockingly resilient genre. And I think that what happens in those cases is, like, Megan sort of became, like, an embraced, sort of very online, like, TikTok-driven event. Smile just like grabbed the cultural consciousness with a great marketing campaign and then good word of mouth that followed. The Black Phone was like, hey, the dude that made Doctor Strange came back to horror and made like a straight up like crowd pleaser. And so I think that those like the reviews and word of mouth took what would have probably been a hit no matter what and then elevated it to another point. So I think that's sort of what can happen with horror. I think the only example this year you've seen where it just didn't work no matter what was the first Omen, but that was sort of an example of, here's a prequel nobody asked for. And I think what we learned there is that like the Omen franchise doesn't carry a lot of cachet. That movie still made 54 million worldwide, even with that. You know, I think that that's what I would say about the horror genre, having observed this really closely in the past couple of years. is, but
yeah, that makes sense. And The First Omen actually is another example of, like, I thought that movie was pretty darn good. So, you know,
right. But I also think that's why that made as much as it made, you know, I think that movie would have made a couple of nickels if it hadn't been any good. Right. But I think because that was originally greenlit with a direct to Hulu thing in mind, the fact that it made 54 worldwide, that probably boosted its profile a lot for VOD and Hulu and stuff. So I would still wager that might end up being a net positive, but that goes back to my argument that, you know, streaming, direct to streaming movies make almost no sense, because Disney's going to get, what, 27 million back from those ticket sales, probably something like that. That almost entirely covers the budget for that movie. Then all of the streaming and everything else, you know, that's gravy. Whereas if you had just put it direct to Hulu, you get none of that money back. Right. So it's like, I don't know. I still, to me, that still makes more sense. But
okay, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50. In order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy and Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
All right. Any other stories from the box office that you thought were worth pointing out, Ryan?
Well, I think it's well worth pointing out that two Lord of the Rings movies made it back into the top 10 this weekend. It wasn't a significant anniversary for either movie. It wasn't. It's just that, hey, Lord of the Rings, you guys like this, right? How about you want them in theater? You want the extended editions in theaters again for a couple of days? Here you go. And, you know, now Warner Brothers is $4 million richer. Like, what do you know? It's like it. These movies, and also they were only on like 1500 screens, so the per theater average is pretty decent for a re-release like this, and especially for movies that are almost 4 hours long in those extended editions, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. So you know, I think that like the strength of those movies is more than 20 years later still pervasive, and you know, for as much as it, you can look at it as like a bitter cash grab, I completely see why Warner Brothers is making more Lord of the Rings movies, like, because that is a franchise that people still do want to see more from. It seems, you know, for as much as people don't like the Hobbit movies, that trilogy made almost $3 billion. So the evidence is there that is one people do want to see more from. So yeah, I think that's my only thing, is that I think that Hunt for Gollum movie, and the animated War of the Rohirrim, I think their stock just went up a little bit in my mind because those re-releases managed to pull in what they did.
Okay, so a guy named Wes from Dallas-Fort Worth wrote in an email to us, and I was going to save this for another episode because it's a long email and there are a lot of good points in here that I think would lead to good discussions. I'm going to save most of it, but I did want to highlight one part of Wes's email because it goes to what you're just talking about with this Lord of the Rings thing. So Wes is talking in this email about, like, what could theaters do? What kind of changes would we make if we could, to try to fix the theatrical film going industry right now. And Wes offered a suggestion of his own. He says, "One option I would like to see is a studio agreement with theaters where I could rent out a theater for a private or party viewing while being able to select a past movie to watch from the studio's catalog, like a Netflix for movie theaters for special occasions or if friends want to split the bill and pitch in. It's extra money that a studio wouldn't normally see, and it would be huge revenue for the theater if they require a minimum dollar amount of concessions or a food purchase or something like that." And then he says, you know, potentially you could like let the customer bring their own, you know, thumb drive or like file, basically, if they wanted to do it that way. That opens up a little bit more of a sort of
that gets Pandora's really tricky.
That we don't want to get into. But the basic idea that he put forward there is kind of like what you're talking about with this Lord of the Rings thing, right? Like, the idea of taking an existing movie that's in a studio's catalog and just throwing it out into theaters for a little while, the idea of doing that kind of like on demand, almost in person on demand, you know, like come to this theater and here, select from these 50 or 100 titles or something. Now that everything is digital and, you know, you're not actually rolling 35 millimeter film, you know, through a projector or whatever, that seems like maybe something that like studios might actually benefit from, like striking an agreement with theaters. I just thought it was an interesting idea that I haven't really seen before. Obviously, like especially in the pandemic, early days of the pandemic, there was like the private theater thing that you can do at your local AMC or whatever, where like you can rent out a whole theater to watch a new movie, but it's not a movie that you get to pick really. It's just kind of like, here's the options available to you for whatever's playing in our multiplex right now kind of deal.
Well, I will say this is an interesting idea, but it is also one that was practiced well. The industry was still getting back on its feet in like 2021. So I say this because my first experience back to theaters after the pandemic was me and a few of my friends who had gotten like our first dose of our vaccine, but not like our second. We really wanted to see Godzilla versus Kong in a theater. So we rented out a Cinemark just with like the 10 of us we trusted, an entire theater. And it was like $150 plus tax or whatever, because, you know, theaters were just trying to get money at the time. And, you know, we did that. It was awesome. It was a truly wonderful experience. We're like, hell yeah. So a bunch of us were like, hey, that was fun. Can we do that again? And what Cinemark had at the time was you could pick like a classic movie. They had a selection of them and you could rent out a theater and the classics were cheaper. So we paid like $100 to go watch Clue in a theater just with us.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that was a thing.
And it was awesome. It was absolutely fucking awesome. And like, and so this was kind of a thing. Now, I think that price wouldn't necessarily make sense all the time, you know, relative to what a theater kind of has to make to even keep the lights on. Because if you're saying, you know, it's $100 for a 2-hour block or whatever, like that's not a lot of money. But if those people are buying concessions, like this person suggested, whatever, like, the problem I've seen now is that theaters still do rentals, but the prices have gone through the roof again because, you know, like things are somewhat back to normal. But I do think this would be an avenue well worth exploring. The drive-in I worked at out here in Austin, shout out to the Blue Starlight drive-in. Please, if you live in Austin, go check it out. But Josh, the owner, did that as well, where he had these small private drive-in screens that you could rent and kind of pick from a selection of movies. And that did really well. Like there was one of the experiments he ran was literally like a single car screen where like you could do like this private date night basically at like, and he had this projector set up and like you could pick your movie and, you know, that was almost always sold out, you know, like, and you know, it came with like popcorn stuff, whatever. But yeah, I think that's certainly worth exploring, but it's just a matter of like, you've got to get the theaters and the studios on board to agree on like pricing, what movies can't, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think it would certainly be worth it if both sides could come together and figure that out, because if you program well enough, these theaters aren't super sold during the week all the time and even at certain points on weekends. So right. If you just reserved a screen or two in these bigger multiplexes for that reason, I think it could work. And I think it's just a concession seller, if nothing else. But yeah, I personally think that's a great idea, but I don't know why it hasn't. And I got to assume there must be a reason. Like there must be a reason that this can't happen. And I just assume it comes down to money, as it always does.
Yeah, I wonder if there's something in contracts about like theatrical re-releases for certain movies mean that like different actors or producers get paid out in different ways or something like that, like certain percentages and all sorts of language.
That's almost certainly a thing. And then it's also studios are just weird about controlling their libraries too.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I don't know. So I got to imagine that there's a way to make this work where like you have a rotational number of movies that just kind of get changed out at different, exhibitors. And yeah, I don't know. I think that like what we've seen is people, the audience seems somewhat limited on paper, but the audience is there for like classic movies that people wanted, like something that you never got to see in a theater. People would like to see that in a theater. And especially if you could sort of choose your own adventure that way, I think that'd be a way to pump some money into the business. So if anyone at Cinemark, AMC, Regal is listening, I think that's a great idea. Not that my opinion matters, but you should listen to me and this guy who sent in that email, because I think it sounds smart.
Yes, thank you to Wes for sending that in, and hopefully we'll get a chance to address the other points that he mentioned in that email as well.
Thank you, Wes.
Seriously though, if you are a person who is in a position of power at an exhibitor like that, write us in and let us know maybe why or why not that is a good or bad idea, or like what kind of challenges we don't know about that might be presenting themselves, or something.
And not to speak for Ben, maybe we could talk about it on the podcast if someone's in a position of power and you want to come on. Hey, why not?
Yeah for sure. Okay, so let's see, any other stories from you kind of, now that you're getting into the Lord of the Rings stuff, that was sort of what the 8 and 9 slot at the box office. There, so any other stories jump out at you that you wanted to mention?
Nothing huge. Just that, you know, it was kind of another weekend where we failed to cross the 100 million mark total at the domestic box office, right? Like it was, you know, another sub-$100 million summer weekend, which sucks, so that's sort of the, where you get into the macro where it's like, I did have good news for you. Yes. But, I think the getting to the macro of it is that like, yeah, look, a $56 million weekend does not come close to making up for the losses that the industry has suffered in the first half of this year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's another example of this movie taken on its own terms is doing well, but you know, we're still, ticket sales are lagging like 24% behind last year still. So, you know, it's, there's still a lot of ground to make up. I don't know where that ground is going to be made up. Inside Out 2 is looking very promising, opening weekend. We have Despicable Me 4 around the corner. So there's some help on the horizon for sure. But, we got a lot of ground to make up. So, you know, at the very least, this movie performed in line with expectations, which we can't really afford more like underperformers. So that's good.
I was just going to say, like, I think we've hopefully laid the expectations out for people to know that like, it's extremely unlikely that ground is actually going to be made up by the time we get to the end of 2024. So I hope that we're not trying to, set people up for failure or something, like
who are listening
to this from afar and wondering how things are going to go. Like, I feel like the narrative has been pretty well established that this year at the movies is going to be behind last year in terms of the gross or whatever.
There's no question. We're not getting to 9 billion domestic this year, but I guess what I'd like to see is by the end of it, that number not being 24% behind, maybe we can make up some, that's what I'm getting at. It's like, can we swing the pendulum a little bit the other way? Like 100%. That would be nice. You know, if we could maybe get that number down to like 10% or something, you know, that would be nice. But
yeah. Speaking of listener emails, I wanted to mention one more. Dan from Helensburg, Australia wrote in, "Hey, Ben and crew, I'm a big fan of the show. I thought Red Letter Media's piece on cinema attendance was very well done. It talks about many of the same issues you and Ryan have spoken about in your show, as well as offering some new opinions. I thought it might spur some interesting conversations." I apologize to Dan. Neither Ryan nor I had a chance to watch this video, which is an hour long, but I did link to it in the show notes, this Red Letter Media piece. So if anybody out there listening has been interested in some of the stuff that we've been talking about in the past couple weeks, especially in terms of like performance and how that could impact, theaters closing and all that kind of stuff, check out this video. I plan to watch it at some point, but yeah, just an hour long video was like a little much for me to try to squeeze in before we started recording today. So Okay. Any other things that I wanted to talk about with you, Ryan? I'm trying to think. Oh, yes. I wanted to mention, you have a column on slashfilm.com called Tales from the Box Office. I don't know if we, I think we've alluded to it. We've mentioned a few of your columns on different episodes, but I don't know if I've laid it out quite in these terms. But if people who are listening to this, that, we've gotten so many emails, Ryan, people being like, I love Ryan, he's great. Like, I love the box office analysis, that kind of stuff. If people are just listening to the show and not going to slashfilm.com, go to slashfilm.com and read especially Ryan's Tales from the Box Office columns, which publish every Saturday. And this most recent one, I just wanted to tee you up to tell me a little bit about that, because two very, very important movies debuted on the same day in the 80s, and you wrote an anniversary piece about that in your latest column.
I did, yeah. So one thing I think that, like, I write a lot about the things we specifically talk about on the podcast, so like the weekly box office stuff, but I do think the thing with Tales from the Box Office is it's my baby. For one, I love it, but it's stuff that we don't talk about on the show. Like, and so what it often is tied to an anniversary of thing or something that came out recently. So my most recent edition, as Ben said, is the headline is 40 years ago, two stone cold 80s classics ruled the box office at the same time. And for those of you who don't know, Ghostbusters and Gremlins, against all logic, opened on the same exact day 40 years ago. It was and yet they both were gigantic hits. And you know, outside of Barbenheimer, that doesn't really happen. That goes against the current logic we have. And so it was, I sort of looked at this as like, how did this happen? Why did it happen? Why doesn't that happen now? And I sort of break all this stuff down, it very thoroughly, and sort of give like a bit of a historical account of this thing with a little bit of, you know, what we can learn from whatever the thing it is that I'm looking at that week. So if you don't read that and you like my box office stuff, I think, not to sort of be whatever about it, but I think it's the best thing that I do. It's my favorite thing that I do. And I think that if you like this box office stuff, that would be something, you know, to check out for sure. So.
Yes. So I'm going to put a link to the most recent column in the show notes for this episode, so you can find it very easily there. But as always, we just encourage people to go to slashfilm.com. Like, the podcast is an extra thing. Like, the site is where all of the real stuff lives. And that's kind of like how we make money and survive and like keep the show alive. Right. So like,
We make. And if you guys, like, as I mentioned, that column is my baby. And as the editors know, and probably like privately get annoyed about, like, every Friday I'm pulling my hair out getting that thing pulled together at the last second, and like I'm always like, why do I do this? Nobody's begging me to do this. I hate this. And then like once it's done, I love it. So like, just like, please justify my insanity and read the column. It would mean a lot to me.
You just described like the process of writing anything for me, Ryan. It's like, why am I doing this? And then once it's done, I'm like, ah, thank God that actually turned out.
Yeah. Okay. I can crank out like a news piece without like really pulling my hair out too much, yeah. But like Tales from the Box Office, I put in so much, like, and I put in more work than anyone asked me to do. Like, it's just like, it's all me. And I just, but like only because I just want it to exist. So like, I have to do it. And so like, if you could just read it a little bit, that would make me so happy.
Excellent. All right. Well, that's going to do it for today's show. You can find more about all the stories that we mentioned on the show at slashfilm.com. I will link to a few of them in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.